KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race.
When they break apart assumptions that I make about them or assumptions that they're making about themselves about who it is that they feel like they have to be, that's where the magic is really happening.
I'm where I like to be, and I'm about 40% towards female. I do male things and female things, and I'm having a ball.
That's Silverton, Oregon Mayor Stu Rasmussen talking about being satisfied with where he's at, the first openly transgendered mayor in the United States. Before that, we heard poet and teacher Damon Arendelle talking about why he likes to work with young poets, and President Obama talking about investing in research like mapping the human brain. That's from his State of the Union address last week. All subjects we're going to touch on this hour on KUOW. This is 94.9 FM KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. Before we get to all that, some breaking news. The Washington Supreme Court today issued a long-awaited ruling on the two-third majority requirement. That's a law that requires any tax increase in the state to receive approval by two-thirds of voting lawmakers before that tax increase can be enacted. The High Court ruled 6-3 that the supermajority requirement violates the state constitution's plain language that forbids the people or the legislature from passing a law requiring more than a simple majority to enact tax legislation. And joining us with more is our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Hey, Austin.
Good morning, Marcy.
This is a long-anticipated ruling. The court heard arguments in September.
Yeah, that's right. And the original thought was that the court would probably rule by the end of the year before the legislative session got going, because having a bright line ruling on this issue is kind of important for lawmakers.
Yes, it is.
So they had to wait several weeks. We're, you know, almost halfway into the session, but they haven't even really begun to take up the budget or tax issues. So I guess it comes just in the nick of time.
Do you know why it took them so long to issue this ruling?
Well, court watchers will tell you that it could indicate, difficulty getting a majority, although in this case we're now seeing a 6-3 decision. The ways and the internal workings of the court are always a bit of a mystery, and certainly there is plenty and ample opportunity to review the majority opinion and then to give the other side the chance to write the dissenting opinions and then for the majority to respond to the dissenting mm-hmm. opinion. And there, so that process can take time. But, you know, the bottom line is that this is a very significant ruling. I mean, going back to 1993, Initiative 601 was the first time Washington voters said they wanted a two-thirds threshold for taxes. It's been more than 20 years. And this has been litigated before, and never before, as I understand it, have the plaintiffs, those trying to overturn this, gotten the standing, if you will, to actually have the court get to the merits of the case. And now, for the first time, that's happened, and on the merits, a majority of the court has said that this two-thirds threshold, popular as it may be with voters, it passed with nearly a two-thirds majority the last time it was on a ballot last November, is still unconstitutional.
Now, you talked about the plaintiffs. It was a wide group that challenged this law in this time around. Lawmakers, the education community, it really was a huge group that came up through the courts. How is this challenge, do you know, besides the fact that this is the first time it had standing, how is this challenge specifically different from the others that have gone through?
Well, it was a very orchestrated challenge, because what happened is this group of mostly freshman lawmakers, although not exclusively in the House, Democrats, basically staged a vote on the floor of the state House to close some tax exemptions, or they would say loopholes, to fund K-3 class size reduction. And then they orchestrated and staged a basically call and response, if you will, with the Speaker of the House, who said, you know, this has passed with a simple majority, but that doesn't meet the supermajority majority threshold to close tax loopholes, which is viewed under the law, or was viewed under the law, as raising taxes, and therefore it doesn't meet the standards. So they could then go to the courts and say, look, we were harmed, but it was clearly orchestrated, this event, because they knew what the outcome was going to be. They could show they could muster a simple majority, but not a supermajority, and that, they said, was the harm.
So at this point, what does this mean? As you just said, the voters approved yet again another two-thirds majority in the last election, an initiative that would require that for a tax increase. Does this ruling nullify that?
It does, and it completely changes the rules of the game, if not the dynamic here. I mean, I don't think what this means is an across-the-board tax hike is suddenly likely, because the governor, Governor Jay Inslee, a Democrat, campaigned against that idea. And you also basically have Republican control of the state Senate. That said, it certainly makes it easier to, as part of a final package, a go-home package, makes it easier to muster a simple majority vote potentially to close some tax exemptions or loopholes, which the governor said he wants to do, perhaps to extend some existing taxes. They could now do that with a simple majority vote, and that seems more plausible, just to be able to muster that kind of support in this climate. It also could have impacts for a gas tax increase. You know, this is a significant policy change.
The ruling came out less than an hour ago, probably about 40 minutes ago. I don't imagine that you've had time to get any reaction, but perhaps because you're so intrepid, you have, Austin Jenkins. What are you hearing from lawmakers?
I've tried to reach a couple of people in the couple of minutes I had, Marcy, and I don't have a response. There is a 9:15 press conference, which as soon as I'm done with you, I will race over to. But I think maybe the way I can answer the question by not answering it is, here's what the dissenting justices said, and it was a very sharp language in these dissents. One of the lines that jumped out at me is that this is the court here is abandoning the limiting principles of the judiciary, charting a new course for the court to more actively engage in the political process. This change is both wise and unprecedented. The dissent says that this is a disregard of 20 years of precedent. And Jim Johnson, who's a very vocal member of the court, says in a separate opinion, this two-thirds threshold in no way violates our state constitution. And just, I would add more broadly, Democratic majorities have suspended the two-thirds requirement in order to pass taxes. So that's nothing new here. The dynamic that this changes is going forward into the future. Every couple of years, we've seen a Tim Eyman-backed initiative to reinstate this, and it has been, in the minds of Democrats in particular, a set of handcuffs on them. Now, the only way, the court's saying the only way to have a two-thirds threshold is a constitutional amendment, which is two-thirds of the state legislature plus ratification by the people. That, in this climate, seems highly unlikely at this point. And so it seems like this decision and the simple majority threshold will stand for some time, if not many years to come.
Well, Austin, I'm going to let you run off in your 2.5 minutes you have to get to that press conference, and we'll be looking for more coverage from you throughout the day here on KUOW. Austin Jenkins is our Olympia correspondent. Thanks for taking time.
You're welcome, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:13. Mapping the Human Brain in a Minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
It's rainy across Seattle. We're at 45 degrees. Forecast calls for rain through the day with an afternoon high of 50. Then rain at times overnight, a low of 46. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:14. A conversation with America's only openly transgender mayor in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. The human brain contains approximately 100 billion neurons. You can think of neurons as little connectors that respond to outside stimuli, then link up to form pathways in our brains. That's a very simplistic explanation. But at this point in time, the brain's still largely a mystery to researchers as well as to folks like me. That could change in the coming decades. At his State of the Union address earlier this month, President Obama called for a brain mapping project, something like the successful human genome mapping project. Joining us to talk more about what a brain project would look like and about some of the research already underway is Dr. Patricia Kuhl. She's a professor and co-director of the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, iLabs for short. She's in Washington, D.C., joining us by phone. Hi, Professor Kuhl. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, hey, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So you are in the nation's capital to talk specifically about the president's proposal. And so I'm hoping that you can explain a little bit more about what a big brain mapping project would be.
Well, it's very, very interesting, and it sounds like it's going to be quite broad in the end. But it's like a tale of two cities here. On the one hand, they're discussing sequestration and budget cuts. And on the other hand, there's tremendous excitement about brain science and what can be achieved that will help all aspects of society, even our littlest children.
And it wouldn't come cheap. So we're talking about cutting budgets and funding hundreds of millions of dollars, probably $1 billion worth of research, right?
Exactly, exactly. So it's not clear where that money is going to come from. And there's different proposals. One is a very broad initiative that describes a sort of approach that has three prongs. And one of those prongs has to do with cognition and learning. Another prong has to do with traumatic brain injury. And yet a third prong has to do with the disabilities of the brain, such as Alzheimer's and autism. It's a very broad attack allowed by the brand new tools of modern neuroscience. I mean, the fact that we can actually get in there and see what's happening.
Which is something that you and iLabs have been working on with the most sophisticated technology. So this multi-pronged approach seems like it's a little bit more complicated than the Human Genome Project, but maybe it's because I don't know a whole lot about science.
Well, this is big science. This is the kind of thing that's going to take many, many participants and cooperation among the federal agencies that fund and even private-public partnerships to provide the kind of funding that would need to be there to attract the scientists and the broad array of scientists that are needed. In my own case, and that's different than what Christoph is tackling, we're looking at the littlest children, and the scientific tools we've now developed over the last 3 to 5 years allow us to look in detail at the active brain, a child learning in real time, so we can see movies of the structures of the brain, the fiber tracts of the brain, and the activity, the current flow in the brain as the child processes a word in their own language as opposed to listening to a word from a foreign language. So we've got opportunity to do something we've never before been able to do. So we can tackle what is the science of learning? What does it mean to learn something? What parts of the brain at one point in time predict months or even years later which kids will be successful at reading and not? How memory actually forms and functions to allow you to recall various things about the sights and scenes and sounds that you need to put to work when you attempt to create a new idea, to be innovative.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Kuhl of the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Science, and this is research that you've already started, Dr. Kuhl. So how would what you do would you fit into this overall brain mapping project, or, I mean, how would that work?
Well, there'll be many. We don't know exactly on the ground how it will work, and there are going to be many aspects to it. If you look at the bill that Representative Chaka Fattah has offered, it has this sort of broad perspective, and that means we believe it's going to fund many different kinds of aspects. So tracking the individual neurons across the whole brain, that's one look at a sort of molecular level. Another level is a systems level that looks to the operations of the brain that we're most interested in, cognition. How do kids come to the ability to solve problems? How do they acquire a language and use that language to read and understand information that's not in their world, but something that introduces new worlds to them? How is it that they form moral judgments? How do they control their impulses? All of these things are successful to school and indeed to life. And we know that the opportunities for the brain to acquire that information, the opportunities to learn, are not equal across children in the United States or again, the world. The opportunities to learn are not equal. And so it's important that we understand during these critical windows of opportunity early in development, what do children's brains need to function at their optimum level?
Now, it sounds so exciting. Obviously, this is something that you're invested in, but not every neuroscientist in the country actually supports the idea of a big brain mapping project that would involve multi-university research, do they?
I think that that's true. No matter what you put on the table, what proposal you put on the table, there will be critics. And it depends how, in the end, it actually looks. I think we're now at the ideational stage. It's not sure on the ground how it will actually function. At the point at which bills are offered and the president's made, created an initiative, it will go to the Office of Science and Technology Policy to create a working plan, you know, for on the ground. And right now, we can't describe exactly how that's going to work. I think at this point, what people are excited about is the potential. We've turned to brain science as a way to ameliorate some of society's ills, and that goes from Alzheimer's and autism to preparing children for school, because the preparation gap is something that our country needs to solve if we're going to create a citizenry that can be innovative and take the jobs that we have open in our companies and industry, as opposed to them shopping around the rest of the world for well-trained people to work in their companies.
Do you have any sense of the timetable for an official proposal about this brain mapping project?
Well, when we asked here in Washington what the timetable was, no one could give a specific answer, but everyone gave the response fast.
Fast. I had heard at least one report March, which is tomorrow. So
exactly.
Perhaps not that fast.
Well, I would imagine it to be in the next 12 months, which is very fast for anything that takes government action.
Huh. And then if this is actually proposed and enacted and funded, your work at iLabs would fit into the overall project?
We are going to compete, and I believe we will be competitive. So, yes, we will be right there attempting to convince the powers that be that some energy and some resources ought to be put into development of the mind of our youngest citizens, because they have tremendous potential. We've now developed the technology that allows us to see the brain in action, to make predictions, to understand how these critical windows of opportunity in development, what opens them and what closes them, how do they actually work? And so, yes, we think that that's a winning argument. We have found all over Washington that is a winning argument. And so whatever form this competition takes, we will be right there.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Yeah, thank you for asking me.
Dr. Patricia Kuhl is a professor and co-director of the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, iLabs. And as you heard her speak, you realize that she's focused primarily on very young children and finding out where learning takes place in our brains. Joining us to talk more about his own research is Dr. Christoph Koch. He's a professor of biology and engineering at California Institute of Technology. He's also the chief scientific officer at the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. Dr. Koch, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Hoshi.
Your research is quite a bit different from Dr. Kuhl's learning focused. You're actually mapping in the way that President Obama is hoping we map human brains. You're thinking of mapping mouse brains, correct?
Both mouse and human brains. So we are much closer than paired to the cellular level. In order to understand chemistry, you need to know about atoms and electrons. And in order to understand about perception and consciousness and memory and its various pathologies and diseases, you really need to know about nerve cells. And there are a lot of nerve cells, and they're very tiny, and they're very complex, and they interact in very, very complicated ways that we're only beginning to faintly understand. And so the bulk of the Brain Activity Map project is going to be dedicated towards developing tools to be able to listen in to the individual neurons chatter away. We can hear them. If you put a piece of a microelectrode, a piece of wire in the brain and amplify it, you can hear them chat. They have this distinct staccato sound. They fire these pulses. So we know that since 50 years, but what we really need to do, we need to listen to tens of thousands of them, and they all have a distinct voice.
Well, people have talked about 80 to 100 billion neurons in a human brain, which is a number that I actually can't conceptualize. How like a human brain is a mouse brain?
If I give you a little piece of monkey brain or mouse brain or human brain, only an expert can tell them apart. Per volume, they look really very, very similar. They're not the same. They all have distinct hallmarks. A mouse brain is slightly different from a human brain, but the biggest difference is the size. Our brain is roughly 1,000 times bigger, so there may be 80 to 100 billion neurons. As you said, that number is as big as the number of dollars we have to start cutting tomorrow in our federal government, just as a comparison. The mouse brain has 1,000 times less. It has maybe 70 million neurons. So it's still a vast number, but it's much more tractable. And the other thing this brain activity map is supposed to do that right now is going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, in humans. We also would like to be able to control the individual nerve cells with pulses of light. Scientists have developed this fantastic technology. It's like you can beam laser lights of different color laser lights at a mouse brain that's suitable genetically modified, and you can turn distinct nerve cells on or off. You can play them like an organ. And that means you can now begin to understand, not only observe, sort of say, okay, whenever the mouse does this, these neurons fire, or whenever the mouse does that, those neurons fire. But now I can make those neurons fire, and I can see, does a mouse do this? I can make those neurons over there fire, and I can see, does a mouse do that?
We're talking with Dr. Christoph Koch of the Allen Institute for Brain Science. And the brain, well, let me take a step back. President Obama compared a brain mapping project that we believe will be proposed next month or tomorrow after the sequestration happens to genome mapping. And I asked Dr. Kuhl this, and I didn't really hear an answer. But it seems to me that we're talking in genome mapping a very fixed amount that's a whole lot smaller than 100 billion. You know, 46 pairs of chromosomes is nothing like 100 billion neurons. So it would seem that the task of figuring out what's going on in our brains is vastly more complex.
That's correct. Yeah, the number of big item scientific projects like the Manhattan Project, the goal was very clear. You want to get a big bang. The moonshot, very clear. You want to put a man on the moon and return him safely. The Human Genome Project, you want to sequence every single letter. In fact, there are 4 billion of them roughly in the human genome. You want to sequence you want to be able to read every single letter in the human genome. We've done that. Understanding the brain is much more difficult. What does it mean to understand the brain? Does it mean I know every one of its components? Does it mean I can list every one of the billion or the 100 billion cells? Does it mean I can fix it in disease? Does it mean I can simulate it on a computer? Those are all different things. And so here the goal is much more long distant. It's much more complicated. It is the most complex system in the known universe. On the other hand, if we want to eliminate such diseases as Alzheimer, as schizophrenia, as autism, if we want to help, as Pat alluded to earlier, you know, our smallest individuals, children, and if we want to cure their diseases, we must understand the brain. And so this is a necessary step on the way to be able to understand the brain and ultimately cure all those diseases that are based in the brain and are off the brain.
So we've known about the diseases for a long time. Why is now the right time or the possible time for studying the brain, whereas 20 years ago it might not have been?
Technology. It's all about technology. We now have the technology to record from thousands. We hoped in a couple of years, maybe 5 years, to be able to record from 10,000. In 10 years, maybe 100,000. In 15 years, maybe 1 million nerve cells, individual nerve cells. So we will be able to listen to all of their distinct voices, and that's very important. Brain imaging is a fantastic tool, but it looks at the power consumption of large chunks of the brain. We need to be able to understand individual nuance and individual voices. And also we now have this technology, this fantastic technology I alluded to earlier called optogenetics, whereby we can manipulate specific neurons in their native circuits. And that's going to be essential to understand it. So because these technologies are now becoming available, pushing them in a big way will enable us to take a long leap along the road to understand the brain and cure it of its diseases.
One thing I've wondered about human brains, because we are so variable as individuals, do we all have specific types of neurons that are exactly the same, or does every human brain look different inside?
The answer is yes. In a sense, we all have very similar cells. I mean, your brain is an organ, ultimately, like your heart or like your liver. And my liver cells are roughly the same as your liver cells. And my heart cells are roughly the same as your heart cells. But they're all distinct based on my unique experience, based on my genome, based on the genome of my parents and my early exposure. If I listen to music my entire life, my auditory brain is going to be different than if you never listen to music. So there's both a common element, which is also, incidentally, why we can study mouse. Because mouse, you can say, it's very different. But it turns out, as I mentioned before, the individual elements, the nerve cells, look very, very similar. The axons, the synapses, the molecules, they're all very, very similar in a mouse, in a monkey, or in a human. But the details matter. And, of course, we have much more of the stuff than a mouse has.
Yes, we do. Dr. Christoph Koch is in our studios with us, and we're talking about brain mapping in anticipation of a federal proposal to institute a nationwide brain mapping project akin to the Human Genome Project, which was completed in 13 years. I know, Dr. Koch, that some scientists say that that we don't even have a place to store all the information that we might get out of mapping a brain, that it's so much information. Just like there's so many neurons.
Yeah, so we also have to develop at the same time storage technology. We have to develop all sorts of technologies to make this possible, but it's well within human ingenuity, and the computer industry now delivers fantastic storage devices where you can begin to store this sort of information. And, other scientists have met these challenges in astronomy, in the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva in Switzerland. They also have massive terabytes and terabytes and exabytes data storage needs, and they can also deal with it. So all these problems can and will be overcome.
How far along are you at the Allen Institute in mapping the mouse brain?
Well, we started last year. So last year, Mr. Paul Allen announced a donation of $300 million or commitment of $300 million towards studying the mouse and the human brain. So that we're now at the end of our first year. It's a 10-year project. We're building up these massive observatories whereby we can observe the brain of a mouse in action as a mouse moves and looks at particular things and makes a decision. We're beginning to catalog its entire wiring scheme. It's called the Connectivity Atlas, where we can to understand a brain, we really need to know its wiring. And
sure.
So one of the first steps we're doing is sort of studying its detailed wiring at the cellular level.
So one of the questions I had, and I think that's what you're trying to explain to me, who's such a ground floor scientist type person, it's a little bit like if I had wiring in any kind of machine, a neuron is something that hooks up, two neurons might hook up and make a pathway. And that we're changing microphones right now because there's something wrong with your microphone there. But are there functions, for example, certain wires in my house might connect up and the light turns on in the kitchen. And then there are specific dedicated connectors that have to do with another room. Are neurons like that? They're dedicated to certain tasks?
They're amazingly specific. So the great moral of 20th century biology is specificity. Biology is all about specificity. They're individual gadgets, they're mechanisms that subserve very specific function. In the visual system, we know there are some type of neurons that convey only one type of color. There are other neurons that only convey the difference between two colors. There's some neurons that have a particular morphology, a particular shape that only respond to motion to the left. There are other neurons that only respond to the motion to the up or down, the other nerve cells that only respond to the overall brightness to control my pupil diameter or the size of a pupil in a mouse. So all of these things are subserved by specific mechanisms. And it's really important to understand these mechanisms in order to be able to understand the brain. Right now, if you have a psychiatric disease, if you feel depressed, you go to a psychiatrist and he gives you a questionnaire, right? That's so which haven't really changed over the last 60 years. And then we give you a drug like Prozac, which essentially means we dump the drug into your brain. That's like taking my car to a mechanic, saying the mechanic doesn't understand anything about cars because he doesn't know about what's inside the car. And he knows that if he pours oil over the entire car, some of that oil is going to hit the motor and will do some good. But it also does all sorts of side effects, right? So that's the position right now. So in order to understand such diseases as depression, schizophrenia, autism, we really need to know what's wrong in the individual specific wiring. And we know already enough to say there are probably at least 1,000 different cell types. And the way these cell types are wired, just like you mentioned in your house, they're wired in very specific ways. And we have to catalog those ways. We have to do a complete catalog of all those different wirings to be able to understand what's normal in a normal brain and what's abnormal in a sick brain.
So ultimately, a goal of all of this might be the Human Genome Project has resulted in targeted gene therapies for cancer, for example. We might get a very specific targeted therapy for schizophrenia or for some of the other diseases of the brain that right now we're just pouring the drugs in and hoping that they hit it.
That's correct. The ultimate goal is to ameliorate human suffering and to eliminate, to contain and ultimately eliminate all those diseases of the brain.
I'm curious, taking a few steps back, how, when we talk about a neuron that controls whether our eye moves to the left or the right, or all the many things this complex computer in our heads actually does, how did we first start knowing, we being the scientific community, you, I guess, that neurons were so specific?
Well, the first inkling of this came in the 19th century when neurologists realized, in particular in France and in Germany and Austria, that you have specific patients that have a specific hole somewhere in the brain that have a particular type of deficit. So, for example, one of the most famous patients, he couldn't speak. He had difficulty understanding speech or being able to speak himself. And then the neurologist realized, oh, this happens whenever there's a lesion in this particular part of the brain, essentially a hole in this part of the brain. So people first became the inkling from the clinic that there is a specific relationship between structure and function, that some parts of the brain seem to be responsible for things like vision, for things like color or motion, or for things like sense of cells or language or speech. And then people discovered, putting these pieces of brain under microscope, they saw this incredible, beautiful, intricate forest of cells. And they have different shapes, just like in a forest, there are different shaped trees. Just similar in the brain, there are different shaped neurons that look very different. And now we know by putting a microelectrode next to them and listening to them, they behave in different ways. They talk in different ways, if you want. And also they have different molecules. We can now see in terms of the gene expression, one of the things the Allen Institute has done is express all the genes in these different brain areas. You can see different neurons express different genes, and which gives rise to different function. And so we need to put all of that vast knowledge together.
How far along on this overall quest are we at this point?
We don't know. We do not know where we are. We know we have to. It's a long voyage, just like any other trip. You take one step after the other. There are roughly 60,000 neuroscientists today on the planet, so it's a very big field, and we are making progress. But as I mentioned before, this is the most complex system known to us, and it's going to be a while before we fully and completely understand how the brain gives rise to the mind.
So you are actively engaged in this work at the Allen Institute. How would what you're doing fit in with a federal project that the government comes up with, or wouldn't it?
Oh, it would fit in perfectly. In fact, we've been involved with this project from early on. It would fit in because one of our missions is to also develop technology and then to make this technology available to the largest number of people. So it's a wonderful complementary effort to further develop technology, to further refine the technology and make it available to the larger scientific community.
So as you mentioned, you don't know how far along you are because the brain is such a big mystery. It took 13 years to map the human genome. Any guess how long it would take to map a human brain?
To fully understand and map the human brain, not the brain of a smaller creature, is probably something, it's a lifetime. I imagine it's going to be, before we fully understand, it's going to be, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. But mind you, once we do, that's a tremendous achievement, because then we should be able to understand the diseases, and we may be able to eliminate or to cure many of them. We'll also, of course, understand, should be able to understand that most fundamental of all mysteries, namely human consciousness, and how does consciousness, or in particular human consciousness, arise out of the brain. So that is a worthy challenge.
Oh, it's fascinating. Dr. Christoph Koch is Chief Scientific Officer at the Allen Brain Institute in Seattle. The President and Congress are perhaps going to propose a plan for a nationwide brain mapping project as early as next month. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is KUOW.
There's only one openly transgender mayor in the United States, Stu Rasmussen of Silverton, Oregon. And we're going to talk with Mayor Rasmussen in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Vermeer's woman in blue reading a letter is mysterious.
We don't really know what she's reading, whether she's reading something that's just arrived, perhaps she stood up to read something important.
I'm Susan Stamberg. The painting is in Los Angeles right now, raising questions which the artist leaves us to answer. Come see on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Hi, this is Melissa Block with NPR News. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you stories you won't hear anywhere else. Stories that go beyond the headlines and keep you inspired and informed. Your financial support makes this all possible. If it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. Thanks.
It's 45 degrees in Seattle and rainy. Rain's going to stick around through the day with an afternoon high of 50. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:40. State lawmakers are considering changes to the way the state's retirement plan works. More on that in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. In 2008, the small town of Silverton, Oregon, population under 10,000, made history. Voters in the Willamette Valley community near Salem elected Stu Rasmussen, their native son, to be the mayor. Rasmussen received more than 52% of the vote to his main opponent's 39%. That in itself wasn't all that groundbreaking. What was is the fact that Stu Rasmussen is an openly transgendered person, the first to be elected to the job of mayor in this country. By the way, mayor is a volunteer job in Silverton. Stu Rasmussen's been active in civic politics in his hometown for more than 30 years, but he actually owns the movie theater in town. Stu Rasmussen identifies himself as a heterosexual man. He's been with his partner, Victoria, for more than 37 years, but Stu has had breast implants. He's got long red hair, long polished nails, and when I met him, he was wearing a revealing black top, a tight black skirt, and heels. This is his normal dress for work. I asked Stu Rasmussen when he first knew that he wasn't a traditional boy.
Well, truthfully, I'm like most transgender people or cross-dressers or wherever I am on the spectrum. Most of us started as teenagers, probably around puberty, when it was a sexual identity thing and you weren't sure where you were going. And, you know, some people get attracted to tall women, tall, thin women. Others like shoes, or, you know, it's hard to describe mm-hmm. what attracts you. And for me, I can't put my finger on it. My mother was always a very classy dresser, and that may have been an influence. But somewhere along the line, my gender identity, I mean, there's 100% male and 100% female, and most of us, it's like being short or tall. Not everyone is 7 feet tall or 4 feet tall. We're all in the middle somewhere. On a gender identity spectrum, many people are not thunked up against the stops. You know, they're a little bit in between, and I figure I'm where I like to be, and I'm about 40% towards female. I do male things and female things, and I'm having a ball.
You're the only openly transgendered mayor in the United States. There probably are many others, or some others, or some amount of people, because this is a society that doesn't necessarily want to talk about spectrums. We want to talk about dualities,
mm-hmm.
boys
yeah.
and girls, and there is no in-between normally.
Right, it's not binary. It's like being short or tall.
So at what point did you decide, you know, the heck with that closeted part of my life. I'm who I am, and this is who I am. I can be okay with it in public.
Well, it took a long time. I think probably access to the internet, because, you know, in a small town, you don't really have many models, but access to the internet in the early 90s and going out and looking for various things and finding, like, support groups or information about transgenderism, transvestism, transsexualism. I mean, there's multiple terms for multiple places on the spectrum. I found a support group in Portland, about 40 miles from Silverton, the Northwest Gender Alliance. And first time I went to a meeting was in boy clothes just to see what it was like. And I met engineers. I met retired naval architects. I met doctors that were, you know, this was something that they did, but it was still fairly well closeted. And I guess with that amount of information and the times were right for everyone to start to sort of make that move, I just made it a little farther than others.
It's one thing for you to feel comfortable where you are, mm-hmm. but another thing for political colleagues, if that's the right term, to feel comfortable having you in there being yourself.
Getting in the mind of a voter is difficult, and that's not really my thing. I'm an engineer. I'm not a touchy-feely kind of person to get into emotions.
Maybe not emotions, but a politician and a long-term politician.
Maybe too long.
I'm not one of your constituents, so I can't judge you on that. But one of the things that I read about that aftermath of that election is the folks from the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas came, as they are wont to do, came to your town to protest.
To protest the community's ridiculously flawed selection of me as the mayor.
And that the community came out in force to counter-protest.
I will apologize in advance because this is a sensitive issue to me, and I generally end up crying when I talk about the community. But we got notice from the Westboro Baptist Church, and this is their modus operandi. They send press information. They send releases to the newspapers. They let the police departments and law enforcement know that they're coming and to expect all sorts of terrible things to happen because it seems to be their mission to foment violence. As nearly as anybody can tell, they do this solely for the purpose of being able to incite some sort of violence, and then if it happens against them, they then have legal action to sue for damages. And it's a strange and bizarre business plan. They call themselves a church, but they are as far from anything Christian as I can ever imagine. I mean, I don't claim to be a Christian, but if I was, it certainly wouldn't be in that vein.
What really impressed me about the story was that your community in large numbers came up and gave the figurative finger and maybe the literal finger, I don't know, to these people.
You know, when they announced that they were going to come to Oregon, and Silverton was one of the stops that they had to make to save the planet. That was Portland, Newburgh, and Silverton. People asked me, well, what should we do about these people? And, you know, they got some media attention. I said, well, let's not do anything. Let's not give them the soapbox to stand on that they so richly want, because it will just demean all of us. And the community wouldn't stand for it. And this is not a Stu thing. This was a Silverton thing. We have made our decision. It's none of you guys' business. Just go away. And that was, I believe that's the message that they wanted to give them. And I really did ask people not to do anything, not to give them a platform, but they wouldn't. And grandmothers, mothers, brothers, sisters, fathers turned out, hundreds of them.
And you're making me cry, too. I think that's a remarkable, I think maybe the most remarkable part of your whole story, that your community clearly, I'm sure, you know, everybody has personal enemies here and there, but that your community would gather in force to say he's one of our own.
Well, like I say, it wasn't a Stu issue. It was a Silverton issue. They were attacking our community, and that's inappropriate. It's nice that a line was drawn there, and the community said, go away. No.
We're sitting in this room with your very, very long-term here. Would you like a tissue? So we just heard Victoria laughing in the corner, 37-ish years together.
37 or 38. Yeah, we've lost count.
That's a long, well.
Yeah, we don't have an anniversary because we never got married. We figured that would just spoil the relationship.
You might want to put a ring on it at some point. No?
You never know.
You never know.
Now we're at the point where, you know, retirement is looming and you have to look at, well, which would be better financially long-term with Social Security and everything, and hard to tell. Haven't gone down that road yet.
Well, I think about it in Washington State because voters just approved gay marriage, and you are not gay. You are heterosexual in a heterosexual relationship, but not a traditional one necessarily, and there was a long legal battle here for things like having the right to go to the hospital with your partner that affect anybody of any gender who's in a long-term partnership.
Yeah, and we should probably get our healthcare power of attorneys back in order. It's one of those things that, you know, between that and wills, you just don't really want to go there, but should.
Stu Rasmussen is the mayor of Silverton, Oregon. He was just reelected to a third consecutive term in this volunteer office. Rasmussen's also the subject of a new musical play called Stu for Silverton. The play was commissioned by Intimon Theater to be part of its second summer festival this summer. And right now, Intimon's in the middle of raising money to fund that festival. This is KUOW. Thursday, time for the Art of Our City. Seattle is one of the national hotspots for spoken word poetry. The Seattle Poetry Slam is the city's longest-running performance series, according to Slam organizers. The slams are held every week at Rebar in Seattle. The organizer is Slam master Damon Arundel. He's a poet himself, but for many years, Arundel's day job was in teen counseling services. He left that world a few years back, but Damon Arundel is still immersed in the world of teenagers. He works as an artist in the schools teaching poetry to high school students. He's also involved with Teenage Slam Poets through Arts Corps' Youth Speaks program. Tomorrow night, the Youth Speaks Poetry Slam series culminates with the Youth Speaks Poetry Grand Slam at Seattle's Town Hall. Damon Arundel will be there, not on stage, but behind the scenes, coaching competing poets. They'll be vying for one of five spots to move on to the National Youth Poetry Slam. Damon Arundel says he's not the mentor, but he's one of many people who work with the youth.
There's way too much goodness there for just one adult to be trying to wrangle. So I've definitely played different levels of roles. I've been more involved at different times, like this year. And actually last year, I was asked to help prep the poets right before the competition goes. So I'll be there in the green room on that Saturday talking with the youth before they actually get up on stage.
So prep is mental prep, I assume, but also performance prep?
Some of it is performance. It's more about helping them to get past the idea of the competition in the first place, because it's a ridiculous concept to be judged on your art by random people who won't ever get to read your work unless you get to meet them after the show, and won't ever see you again. So you have this one opportunity, and it's completely random. And as such, it creates this dynamic, and it can be easy for a young poet, for any poet, to get caught up in that. So my big goal is to make sure that they recognize the importance of what it is that they have to say on the mic and the importance of the audience and let go of the competition.
It's interesting. A couple years ago, I did a story about the August Wilson monologue competition, which isn't, although he was a poet, and it was it's a high school thing. And these were theater students.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about the difference between performing Mr. Wilson's words and performing your own words.
Right.
You said a little bit ago that you're up there, you're not talking about something somebody else has prepared, you're talking about something, poetry comes from way deep.
Yeah, it's your own personal thoughts, feelings, experiences, and that's scary. Because you're not hiding behind someone else. Not to say that, actors are hiding, but they're presenting the work of someone else. They are acting as a channel to present it, but it's a whole nother, there's a whole nother level to it when you're presenting your own work.
So the teaching, there's mentoring and there's, but then teaching, are you teaching poetry, writing, reading, appreciation? What do you?
All of the above. There's less performance involved in it because it's a poetry organization that I'm working for, a literature organization that I'm working for. So it's usually not performance focused. It's usually writing and reading and appreciation focused.
So you talked about it being this oral form, and you come in and can talk to the kids about Rodney Dangerfield, or you can talk about the griot, or you know, there's endless things that you can talk about. But when you get the first assignment back, and I'm assuming you make assignments. What resonates with you when you read something and you like, that's it, you've got that kernel, or you've touched, or does everybody have that kernel?
I think everyone has it, but not everyone is ready to open it. What clicks with me is a student showing themselves to me. When I walk into a classroom, they look at me and they will determine certain ideas in their head about who I am. And my job as teacher, but also as performance poet, is to break apart those assumptions. And whenever they do the same thing within their writing, when they break apart assumptions that I make about them or assumptions that they're making about themselves about who it is that they feel like they have to be, that's where the magic is really happening. Where a student in particular that has been kind of quiet, is kind of withdrawn, and all of a sudden when we're doing our final class reading or when they show me a piece of writing and I get to see finally who this person really is or who they could be if they allow themselves to be.
This is such a big part of what you do now, this teaching. I'm assuming that's kind of how you support yourself. But maybe being slam master is incredibly lucrative. I don't know.
No.
I didn't think so, because most things in the arts are not all that lucrative. But how does the teaching come back to you in your own work?
Some of it is in the writing. So I write about my students all the time. I write about the things that come up that they present to me on a pretty regular basis. I write about my life. So that's a main source of inspiration. But the other part is they push me to be an artist. So I consider myself to be a teaching artist. If I'm working with them, I can't consider myself to be a teaching artist unless I'm still growing and putting in my work as an artist. So for a long time, my focus was, all right, I'm teaching. And I kept hearing this voice in the back of my head, where's your legitimacy if you're not writing and performing? And in the work that I do with Arts Corps in particular, that voice kept coming in even more powerfully. So within the last, I'd say, 3 years, I have definitely shifted. As I've moved away from the world of social services, a big part of it has been me embracing my writing and performing.
That's poet, mentor, and teacher Damon Arundel. He'll be behind the scenes tomorrow night. The Youth Speaks Poetry Grand Slam will be held at Seattle's Town Hall. The action will get underway at 7 o'clock. And now, the sound of the day.
That will be in line with what poll show, a majority of Americans want
to see. You might have guessed by now that was the sound of a wind-up radio being wound up. The sound comes to us from listener Rich. He was listening to KUOW the other day when he lost power, and luckily he had his free play wind-up radio from 1998. After cranking it up for 30 seconds, Rich was able to continue listening to KUOW until his power came back on, and we are so glad, Rich, that you had that radio. What interesting sounds are you hearing in your world? Record 30 seconds of those sounds and send them along to us along with the story behind your recording. You can email your sound to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. You can listen to that and many sounds again at our website where we keep our archived shows. That's kuow.org. Lots of things to look at as well as listen to on that website. Coming up in the next hour of Weekday, why is it so darn expensive to buy a used car in Seattle? We're the second most expensive market in the country for buying a used car. What gives? We're going to find out that. Also in the world of sounds, Katie Sewell comes in to talk about some of the people who make sound effects. Sarah Dickerman tells us where to go eat, and you can hear the sound of satisfied mms when your stomach settles down. Also, pension reform. That's a big proposal making its way through Olympia right now that would change the kind of pension plan state workers have. We're also seeing that in the private sector as well. So that's coming your way. We don't want you to go away. Stay with us here at KUOW.
It's 9:59. A new poll shows that a record number of people in California support same-sex marriage. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Global Executive Mini MBA program. Faculty-led tours of India, Japan, China, and Thailand are designed to foster understanding of global business markets and help develop trade contacts, starting this October. More at uwb.edu/business/mini-MBA.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.